Hello, you're listening to the Swiss Info programme for May the 10th. I'm Jo Fay. In 2015, it'll be 150 years since the first group climbed to the very summit of Switzerland's iconic mountain, the Matterhorn. It was an event clouded in controversy, but it put the tiny, tucked-away village of Zermatt bang on the map for a new class of adventurous tourists. I'll find out how a community of farmers created a top-class hotel dynasty and see how they're shaping up for the future. Plus, it's always been about the mountains in Switzerland, but now another tourism hotspot is opening up one of the toughest challenges around to a new audience.
About 150 racers are running up the hill on skis.
We'll hear how competitors in an extreme ski race in Verbier are becoming even younger. But first, we're off to a small village with a big reputation. You're unlikely to hear these kind of farmyard sounds in the centre of Zermatt anymore. Once a small farming village at the end of a valley, it turned into an international ski resort after the first ascent of the iconic Matterhorn Mountain, which towers over the village at its base. The only place you're likely to see or even hear pigs and sheep down in this part of the valley is in the Matterhorn Museum, as part of a 3D exhibit in the underground recreation of Zermatt from times gone by. Rudi Schmidt is the museum's director. He has a wide range of knowledge of how life in his village changed.
The history of Zermatt didn't begin with the first ascent of the Matterhorn. It actually began much, much earlier with the botanists and the naturalists.
In the early 19th century, visitors came for the flora and fauna and took home word of the range of 4,000-metre peaks that overlooked the area. As the century went on, one by one, these mountains were climbed, with the English and their newfound love for mountaineering leading the way. It was the first ascent of the Matterhorn that really brought the sport and the location into the limelight.
The people of Zermatt were just simple farmers at that time. They had no desire to climb the mountain. They had a certain respect for this mountain, the Matterhorn.
All of this changed, though, in 1865, when Edward Whymper came from Britain seeking a guide to make him the first person to reach the top of the Matterhorn. Franz Josef Imboden, now a Zermatt tour guide who's worked in the village in a number of hotels for over 35 years, told me about the expedition that changed things forever as he and I walked through the village's streets.
He found here Father and Son Taugwalder, Zermatt guide. And at the same time here in Zermatt, there were three English mountain alpinists and then a French alpinist also. And then they climbed on the 14th July 1865.
The ascent was a success, but disaster struck on the way back down.
The young English alpinist Heddows, he slept and took the French guide and the other two Englishmen with him. The rope snapped. On the top only was then Mr. Whymper with the two Zermatt guides.
It was an incident that brought international intrigue and attention. Rumours of foul play circulated wildly, and more people wanted to come and see for themselves. The broken rope is still in the Matterhorn Museum today. As Edie Schmidt continues to show me around, he points it out, now kept inside a glass case. A symbol of the catastrophe that signalled the beginning of change for the people of Zermatt.
That is the original rope, a thin rope that was stretched between two thick ones. Four men fell. Of course they didn't have a chance. The rope could take up to 300 kilograms according to reports.
As the visitors kept coming, Zermatt's residents saw their chance, and letting up rooms turned into building hotels. Today, there are 113 hotels in Zermatt, and more on the way. Kevin Kunz is CEO of the Seil Hotels in Zermatt. I met him in one of their hotels, the Monservan Palace, to talk about how he sees their approach, not just to the long-standing British visitors, but to an increasingly international crowd.
The biggest market share is still Switzerland, with around one-third, and then it is very mixed. Then it's British, Russian, Norwegian, Germany. And in summertime, the Asian markets are the main markets.
When your staff first comes to the hotel, is there any specific further training that happens with them when they arrive, perhaps to deal with the different cultures or anything along those lines?
I think because of the internationality of the guests, there are a couple of standards what we really want that they take care of. It is really making the people feel at home, really take care of them as human beings.
Do you think that some guests who come and stay from abroad might expect to be greeted by a Swiss person at reception or have a Swiss person serve them in the dining room? Do you think that they might be surprised that it's somebody from Britain or Germany?
I don't think so anymore. It would be nice, but I think the whole mixture today, if I'm in London, I'm not always served by a Brit. If I'm in Paris, I'm not always served by a French. I think the world is really changing. We're mixing. Open borders means possibilities for a lot of people. I don't see that really as a disadvantage. I see it as an advantage for both cultures, who bring in different sides, different aspects of their culture. But it has to be in a human way. It has to be in a hospitality way.
Katja Orbendorfer is one of the German members of staff. She speaks five languages, including English, Russian and Greek, and works as the room's division manager.
Our guests, they are not all Swiss. They have different nationalities, and I think they like it. If, for example, the Russian girl I had in reservations now, lots of Russian, they really appreciate it that somebody came from their own nationality and spoke to them. Of course, it's respected and they like it.
For Switzerland Tourism, the national organisation that promotes and monitors the industry, a number of countries have been marked out as strategic growth markets over the past few years. They include China, India, Russia and the Gulf States, amongst others. Peter Zombori runs PremiumSwitzerland.com, an online luxury travel agency.
When our clients come to Switzerland or to our other destinations in France or Italy or Germany, they expect really a high-end service, which usually also includes some background knowledge about their culture or just their language. It is for us, of course, to utmost importance to have people from abroad being able to serve these clients, you know, especially Russians or greater Russian area, especially Arabs or Arabic-speaking people and Chinese. No, for us, it's super important.
You mentioned there some knowledge of the tourist's own language and knowledge of the tourist's own culture. Clearly, it's useful when you're a foreigner in a country on holiday to speak to someone in a language you can understand. But this idea of knowing a little bit about somebody's culture, do you think you could tell me a bit more about that?
Just think about the Muslim culture. If you have a Muslim family traveling, you have tons of specific needs that can relate to the Muslim beliefs. It is sometimes not so necessary, depending on how moderate or how strict the families are about their religious feelings. But if you take a concrete example for a Muslim family coming on a summer holiday, you need to make sure that you have a spa only accessible for women, or that you have specific hours where women can only access a spa. You might want to have, for a medical treatment, a female doctor rather than a male doctor. So you need to understand quite a lot of the culture to give a super wealthy traveler, you know, a great holiday experience. And if you don't, then you're lacking something that other countries might be better in.
The allure of the mountains is a big part of Swiss life that appeals to residents and visitors alike. In nearby Verbier, another upmarket Swiss resort, an extreme ski competition is opening up a tough pastime to a younger generation. Daniel Johnson reports for Swiss Info.
It's snowing and I'm high in the mountains for a ski race, but it's a ski race not quite like any other, because these skiers are about to go uphill. And they're off. About 150 racers are running up the hill on skis with backpacks. I don't think I could catch them.
The sport is ski mountaineering. The event is the Patrie des Jeunes. the brainchild of Canton Valais, it's for teenagers too young to compete in the Senior Glacier Patrol Race, which takes place at the same time in Verbier Ski Resort. The sport involves trekking up mountains using super light skis and boots, and all important strips of synthetic material that attach to the underside of racers' skis to stop them slipping backwards. They're called skins. Midway round the course, I catch up with the racers. They're taking off their skins to ski downhill, but not for long, as they've got another uphill section to come.
That's the first skin off. Second skin off, sticks it inside her top, keep it out of the snow, keep it from getting wet. Quick change on the bindings, put them into the downhill mode, and she waits for her team member who's just behind her. She's looking for him, he's coming, and they're off. Allez, courage!
Although ski mountaineering is a fast-growing sport, there's no question it can be very tough. It's also the butt of jokes from downhill skiers. They have trouble understanding why anyone would want to walk up a mountain when there are perfectly good lifts available. So why do you do it? I ask course director Patrice Michelot.
La liberté. La liberté.
Freedom. Freedom. Being able to go up a summit. The physical effort, all these things help encourage teamwork. Ski mountaineering is possibly in fashion at the moment, but I think it's really relevant for everyone. Back to the race, and many participants are taking the snowstorm in their stride. But as conditions deteriorate, the higher racers go, and with visibility next to nil, one racer is clearly struggling. I ask one of the course volunteers if she's stopping.
Elle va s'arrêter la course?
Yes, she replies. She's having trouble. She's got asthma. She perhaps pushed a bit too hard. Given the effort required, the frozen fingers and blisters that are part and parcel of uphill ski racing, you might think it would put most people off. But not this 16-year-old, who I spoke to before the start of the race. Are you ready for the race? Yes, always. It's what I've been training for. And why do you like it so much? I think it's really friendly, original and fun, and with all the nice views around, it's really lovely. In case you're interested in trying it, here's a quick checklist of the things you'll need, in addition to skis and poles. Well, I've got my ski boots in my bag, my helmet, and in another bag I've got my race pack. There's my snow shovel, probe, transceiver that you put next to your body so rescuers can find you more easily if there's an avalanche. Fortunately today, there's no such danger. A couple of hours after they set off, the racers reach the bottom of the mountain safely before sprinting in their ski boots towards the finish line.
Some tired-looking legs here, but they're nearly there, 200 metres before they can put their feet up, and they're going to need to, given the number of kilometres they have run around the mountains today.
For one athlete, it was a long and steep learning curve. It was tough. We set off too quickly. Well, me mainly. I was exhausted. Then I fell a lot and it really tired me out. I should have trained a bit harder.
J'aurais dû me plus m'entraîner, je pense aussi.
Mais quand même, on doit vous féliciter.
Well, I think you deserve congratulating.
Bravo.
Merci beaucoup.
You can find out more about tourism and legendary ski races in Switzerland on our website, swissinfo.ch. I'm Jo Fay. Thanks for listening.